are joined here live in the studios by Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Hello.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
I started it. So no Jav again this week. I sent out a notice yesterday and said he was going to be here. And sure enough, that was what stopped him from being here.
He's still adjusting, apparently, to the dialysis. He's having some blood pressure issues, and so he's at home resting. And actually, I think last week was unusual. I did not expect him back so soon. So if we give him some more time to rest, I think we may see him sooner than we expect.
We might. Mm-hmm. And there's probably going to be sightings of him out and about in Seattle
Weather's beautiful, and it's a University Street Fair weekend, so... if you haven't gotten out and seen the sun yet, you might want to do that right after
time
we're done with
up.
The show. Yeah, time to get up, get out.
All right. Well, it was a busy week, both locally and nationally. And starting with local, hearing this week with Judge Robart.
Yeah, U.S. District Court Judge James Robart finally held his hearing on the new union contract that the city of Seattle negotiated with the Seattle Police Officers Guild. The Police Officers Guild has been working since, I believe it is 2014, without a contract in place. They haven't had any raises. The city had been undergoing police reform now for like the last 7 years. This contract is a key part of whether or not the city has actually hit the target to meet the requirements for actual police reform. Now, Judge Robart is overseeing that process, and it's his job to look at the new contract and to decide if this last piece is in place, and he could finally lift the city out of that whole legal reform process. This week, he said, nope, the city has fallen partly out of compliance because the part of the guild contract that deals with police accountability and disciplinary proceedings against cops who are accused of wrongdoing, that part of the contract is not up to par. It does not comport with the memorandum of understanding between the city and the Department of Justice, and it does not meet the city of Seattle's new police reform legislation that the city council passed last year. Though the judge did not set the clock back on the two-year review period. Now, in January of last year, he said that the city was substantially in compliance, which triggered a two-year review period. And at that time, he had said one of the key pieces that the city has to do to get out of the two-year period is to come up with a good contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild. And he's saying, no, this contract's not a good one. Robart specifically cited the messed up arbitration process that allowed Seattle Police Department officer Adley Shepard to get his job back with back pay after he was fired for punching a handcuffed woman in the back of his patrol car. And Robart showed the police dash cam recording of that incident to the packed courtroom. Robart said that it's, quote, imperative to deal with these accountability issues, end quote. He didn't like that the contract allows a cop suspected of misconduct to choose to have his case heard, the appeal of his disciplinary procedures heard by a labor arbitrator who has no background in police conduct issues, and that arbitrator can then overturn a decision made by the police officer's boss, who is the chief of police. This clearly doesn't meet the requirements of Seattle's police reform laws or the Constitution, according to Robart. Judge Robart seemed to be in full agreement with the Community Police Commission, who had sent a letter to the city council recommending that they reject that portion of the contract that covers police accountability and disciplinary procedures while upholding the portion that covers salary increases and benefits. Robart appeared to be saying exactly the same thing because he upheld the part of the contract that covers salary increases and employee benefits, but he threw out the part that covers accountability and disciplinary procedures. Now, Mayor Durkan, who didn't attend the hearing for some reason, was openly confused about what Robart meant. She said that she would wait to get the judge's written ruling, which he's expected to release in the next week or so, before she'd comment on what the city's next steps will be. And she expressed at that time that she thought, oh, maybe the judge just needs a little more information or clarification of the disciplinary procedures involved in the new contract. But, you know, everybody else, reporters, legal experts, city attorney Pete Holmes, members of the community police commission who were there at the hearing, they all seem to be really clear that the judge wants the city to reopen negotiations with the Seattle Police Officers Guild to change the disciplinary and accountability portion of the contract. Now, according to the new legislation that was passed last year by the Seattle City Council, the Seattle Police Reform legislation, a cop accused of wrongdoing could appeal his or her disciplinary ruling to a three-member city-run commission and a hearing examiner. Now, this process would be much more open and less subject to manipulation, like what happened in the Shepard case, in which the arbitrator agreed along with Shepard's attorney and union representative to delay her decision in his case for political reasons while the city council was reviewing and voting on the new Seattle Police Officers Guild union contract, because they knew that announcing that Shepard was needed to be reinstated with back pay would probably cause a problem there with the city council approving the contract. That's manipulation. For political reasons, Robart, it appears, was particularly disturbed by that whole sequence of events. And that's in part why he showed that video of the dash cam footage that was taken of Shepard punching the woman in the back of his patrol car. Notably, a woman who was handcuffed, I should say. Notably, Seattle City Council member Lorena Gonzalez, who chairs the council's public safety committee, also expressed her disappointment along with Mayor Durkin. And instead of calling for the city to immediately open negotiations with the police union, she wrote, and this is, I think, on her blog, quote, "This is a message we should all take to heart while we eagerly await Judge Robart's written court order," end quote. And I have to say to that, my response to that is no. You know, and this is what drives me crazy about Lorena Gonzalez, is that instead of looking at that contract when it came before the city council, before her committee, and saying, this does not meet the requirements under the new law we just passed that went through her committee, you know, and sending it back to Mayor Durkin and saying, no, you gotta renegotiate the disciplinary process with the guild. Instead of doing that, you know, back in November, in October and November, she just said, oh, let's get this passed and let the judge decide. Well, it's been 6 months now. It's been a little over 6 months now. And the judge has come back with that same decision that she should have made more than 6 months ago. And now she's still waiting. She's still hesitating. Oh, no, no, we don't need to reopen negotiations. Well, yeah, you do. And you got to do your job. You know, Lorena Gonzalez is good on some issues that are small, that don't cost her much political capital. But on these bigger issues that really point to how well are you doing your job? How well are you really doing sound oversight of city government? She just falls down pretty badly, falls in line with the mayor and does not, you know, exercise the city council's responsibilities well.
Waits for someone else to pick it up and deal with it.
And deal with it, yeah. So I was pretty disappointed in her this week.
All right, anything else on that?
Nope, let's move on.
Let's move on to some analysis that came out this week regarding the collapsed crane.
Yeah, the Seattle Times published an article this week, and the title of it was, "What Caused Seattle Crane to Collapse? Experts Say a Common Practice is Likely Cause." Now, the article focused on a shortcut that crane companies use to speed up the process of taking apart and dismantling construction cranes. It's a shortcut that's not legal, at least not in the state of Washington. Now, to take apart a tall construction crane, it's usually put together in segments and then dismantled in segments. And those segments are bolted together with heavy steel bolts. Usually when they take it apart, workers are supposed to loosen and remove the bolts on the top segment, and then another smaller crane picks up that segment and lowers it. Then they go to the next segment, loosen the bolts, dismantle it. Sometimes they remove pieces in two segments at a time. But this shortcut that speeds up the process is when the company that's dismantling the crane tells its workers, go up and down the whole length of the crane and loosen all the bolts at once. so that then when we want to move each segment, all you have to do is remove a couple bolts, a couple already loose bolts, and it'll go faster. Well, that causes a problem when you have high wind gusts like Seattle did on the day that the crane collapsed. That can have lead to really disastrous consequences. And this has happened before. The Seattle Times article cited a construction crane collapse in Dallas in 2012, in which construction workers said that they had gone all up and down the crane and loosened all of the bolts before it was dismantled. And current workers who were interviewed by the Seattle Times said that this is now becoming a common practice, particularly in hot construction markets like Seattle. Seattle currently has more construction cranes than any other U.S. city. This crane was working on the Google building at Fairview Avenue North and Mercer Street. And when it fell, the two top segments landed directly on Mercer Street, one of the busiest streets in the city of Seattle. Four people were killed. Two construction workers on the crane, Andrew Yoder and Travis Corbett, were killed, and two people in their cars on Mercer Street, Sarah Wong, who was a student at Seattle Pacific University. And in an ironic twist, the other victim was Alan Justad, a retired city employee who was the former deputy director of the Seattle Department of Planning and Development, which oversees construction and issues construction permits in the city of Seattle. There were four other people injured in that collapse. Now, the State Department of Labor and Industries is still investigating, and it's not looking good for at least three of the companies that are working on the Google building. GLY, or I guess you could say GLY Construction, they're the overall general contractor. And then the two companies, the subcontractors that were dismantling the crane at the time, Northwest Tower Crane Service and Omega Morgan. Northwest Tower Crane Service was the company that was in charge of the construction crane that collapsed in Bellevue years back. You may remember that one killed a man in his apartment building. Now, a lot of construction contracts pay bonuses if the contractor and subcontractors finish their work early or just finish it on time. With the amount of building that's going on in the city of Seattle and the demand for construction companies to get everybody's project done on time or ahead of time, there can be considerable bonuses involved in larger contracts like with big companies like Google. So I think Ellen, I should be looking at that as well. If Google provided large bonuses to these construction companies and they were under pressure to collect those bonuses and put that kind of pressure on their workers to take these shortcuts, then Ellen and I should come down with some really stiff penalties for both the owner of the property for providing those bonuses and to the companies that rush the work in order to collect that money.
Well, I know from the incident that happened in Bellevue, what was it, 10 or 15 years ago, mm-hmm. when it collapsed, the penalty was like under $15,000.
Yeah, it's usually pretty small. I think the state needs to up those penalties as much as they can. I'm not real clear on whether state law limits those penalties. My guess is it might, but I know that labor and industries can sometimes be under pressure from large companies saying, "What, you don't want our business in the state of Washington? You know, we'll take it elsewhere if you don't go easy on us." So that's worth looking into too.
All right, moving on. Also this week, developments with backyard cottages.
Yeah, on Tuesday, Seattle Deputy Hearing Examiner Barbara Dykes Ehrlichman ruled in favor of an ordinance that would allow backyard cottages and mother-in-law apartments on lots that are zoned for single-family housing in Seattle. The ordinance was, when it was first discussed, the ordinance was appealed by the Queen Anne Community Council, which delayed the ordinance by requesting an environmental impact statement. Once the environmental impact statement was done, it found mostly favorable impacts of the new ordinance. The Queen Anne Community Council then appealed that environmental impact statement to the hearing examiner's office. This decision now clears the way for the city council to hold a hearing on the ordinance and vote on it, and for the mayor to sign it if she wants to. Now, the ordinance would allow a backyard cottage separate from the main home and a mother-in-law unit inside the main home on a single lot. It would not require off-street parking for those units, and the owner of the units wouldn't necessarily have to live on site. It also changes current law to allow up to 12 unrelated people to live on a single-family lot that has a backyard cottage and a mother-in-law apartment. Current law allows a maximum of 8 unrelated people. In addition, the law would limit the size of new houses being built on single-family lots to 2,500 square feet above the ground. Does not include any space below ground on lots that are at least 5,000 square feet. That's to combat the phenomenon of these multi-story McMansions. And I think everyone knows what I'm talking about. In a neighborhood of single-family homes, when someone comes in, tears down an older, smaller home, and then builds a house that's 2 to 3 stories tall or sometimes higher, that is lot line to lot line. There's no front yard. There's no backyard. They cut down the trees. They tear out all the plantings, and it significantly changes the streetscape with that house looming over all the other smaller homes around it. This ordinance would seek to prevent those multi-story McMansions. Now, opponents say that the new law will cause parking problems and will cause older houses to be torn down for developers to build new houses plus backyard cottages. But I think that ignores the fact that new houses are usually built much bigger than the 2,500 square feet in this proposal, because bigger tends to be a lot more profitable for developers, which is why you see those McMansions being built. Height and size limits in single-family zones is going to restrict apartment buildings and duplexes. Of course, owners can rent out the main home on a lot, the mother-in-law apartments, and the backyard cottages. But, you know, they do that now without restrictions. There are a lot of single-family neighborhoods that have homes being rented out, sometimes to many people. Up to 8 is what the law allows. Now, this is one way, of course, to add density to neighborhoods without changing the character of the neighborhood, the streetscape, the tree canopy. Even the number of cars wouldn't necessarily increase dramatically when you take into account that the environmental impact statement said that they expect 2,500 new units to be created by this ordinance in the next 10 years. That's not a whole lot of new housing over 10 years. So I don't imagine it's going to increase a lot of pressure on parking in Seattle. We should, I think, criticize it more for leaving 65% of Seattle zoned as single-family housing instead of identifying areas that could allow low-rise affordable apartment buildings, duplexes, and triplexes with backyard space, maybe front yard space as well, that wouldn't necessarily change the character of a neighborhood, wouldn't change the streetscape much, and would provide a lot of more affordable housing for families. I don't think mother-in-law units provide much affordable housing for families with kids, and backyard cottages are not going to provide a whole lot of space, especially if they take up the backyard, for kids, for families who want a place for kids to play, for example. So, you know, there is something to criticize in the ordinance, but it is, I think, a step forward for some infill density in the city of Seattle. I just wish that they had looked more at allowing duplexes and triplexes.
Well, the kids can just play in the street.
No. Not a good option.
When I was growing up, it was fine. It turned out fine.
You survived it. Let's
yeah,
say.
Well, most of me.
Nowadays, with the kind of traffic Seattle has, I don't know if you'd
true.
Survive
it's
it.
It's a little more traffic than when I grew up. Uh-huh. All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right. Legislation this week regarding hate crimes?
Yeah. A new hate crime ordinance moved through Lisa Herbold's Civil Rights, Utilities, Economic Development, and the Arts Committee on Tuesday. She had said that after looking at the statistics released by the Seattle Police Department on hate crimes in Seattle and the 500% increase in hate crimes since 2000.
400. I was thinking it was 400.
Well, that's what the city was saying. They were looking at only select ones. If you look at the whole number of hate crimes that were listed, it's closer to 500%. and assaults in particular that involved a hate crime as well as violence, those were 524%. They were over 500%. Now, she proposed a new hate crime ordinance that would make it easier for the city to prosecute people who commit hate crimes. And that moved through her committee with a unanimous vote on Tuesday. It would change a hate crime in Seattle from being called malicious harassment to a special designation of hate crime motivation that can be added to any other misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor charge that's brought against a suspect. And what this means is that instead of trying to prosecute a suspect only for malicious harassment, which is hard to it's hard sometimes to prosecute people just for malicious harassment. The suspect can be charged with, for example, assault and then have an additional charge added with a hate crime motivation. So if the prosecutor can't prove the hate crime, they can still prove the assault charge. And this makes it less likely for suspects to go free. Also, it changes changing the name means that Seattle's malicious harassment charge won't conflict with the state's malicious harassment charge, which has stricter penalties. Often suspects are prosecuted under the state law, but not under the city law. Now that it's a separate crime, suspects can be charged with both a state crime and city crimes as well and be prosecuted under both, not one or the other. It also expands the crimes covered by the law to include phone harassment, cyber stalking, and unlawful use of a weapon to intimidate someone, which were not included under the old law. And the list of protected classes and groups has been expanded to include race, color, religion, ancestry, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, mental disability, physical disability, sensory disability for folks who are hearing or sight impaired, homelessness, marital status, political ideology, age, and parental status. It also would require that a person convicted of a crime with hate crime motivation would be required to take a training program or do community service to educate them about the effects of hate crimes on affected classes. Now, the committee passed Herbold's bill unanimously, as I said, and the full council is going to pick it up and vote on the ordinance on Monday. So you can give your thoughts on that to your city, your district city council member.
All right. And finally on local, Friday was a big day. I was following.
Friday was a big day, came and went. It was the filing deadline for city races.
You just missed your, did you throw your hat in?
No, I'm not running for city council.
Okay.
Yeah, although there are around 60 candidates who are. And since the filing deadline is closed, it's time for us to pick up and start looking at who the candidates are in the different races. And I'm starting numerically with District 1 this week. There are only four candidates who filed in District 1, the West Seattle and Southwest Seattle, from Harbor Island and Alki Beach in the north all the way south to White Center and Highline on the city boundaries. First off is the incumbent Lisa Herbold. She's been on the council since 2015, which was the first year that district races were started in the city of Seattle. Before that, she was an aide to longtime progressive council member Nick Licata, and she represents literally decades of experience with city politics through the city council. She's been a key vote in the last 4 years on a number of progressive city laws, from Seattle's $15 an hour minimum wage to tenants' rights laws, to affordable housing votes, and also going to back for legacy businesses, that is, mostly small businesses in neighborhoods that are rapidly gentrifying, where a lot of those small businesses get torn down and evicted. They get evicted and the buildings torn down to build larger properties that then bring in chain stores. More importantly, she's been key in exercising the city council's oversight of city government, particularly through the budget process, but also on issues like homeless encampment sweeps and the navigation team audits. Now, on transportation, she's also been one of the leading critics on the Seattle streetcar system, which is way over budget, still has not been finished, and is vastly underperforming its stated goals in terms of both ridership and revenue. On the other hand, she did vote to approve the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract, mainly to deliver salary increases to police who've been working without a contract for over 4 years. But she didn't push hard to send it back to Durkin on accountability issues, and she probably could have done that. Also, she originally voted for the employee hours tax and then voted to repeal it a month later. She was one of the votes to repeal it. Herbold has raised the most cash in this race so far, around $55,700, with a large number of progressive donors behind her, and also quite a few folks who work for nonprofits and groups that provide affordable housing and services to the homeless. So that's where her support is coming in. Her two challengers so far do not seem to have the same kind of oomph she has, particularly in raising money. Attorney Philip Tavel, a former teacher and video game developer, ran against Herbold back in 2015, the first year, again, that the city council was on the district system. But Tavel didn't make it past the primary. Herbold narrowly won that race against Shannon Braddock in her district. Again this year, Tavel's campaign is extremely vague. He wants to, quote, deliver effective results, end quote, and bring trust and respect back to the discussion. He has no discernible policy positions that I can figure out, although he says on his website, this is another direct quote, I understand the needs of small and large businesses as well as residents, end quote, which should give you, I think, some clue that he's fishing for Chamber of Commerce money and support, although he hasn't drawn any support from business groups, any measurable support from business groups yet. He's raised about $14,000 from a lot of mostly individual donors, and he's put over $11,000 of his own money into his campaign. And that still leaves him at $25,000, at less than half of what Lisa Herbold has raised. Now, the other candidate that's vying against Herbold is Seattle Police Officer Brendan Colding, who appears to be running on a straight Republican platform. You know, show cops the respect they deserve. Kind of typical Law and Order Republican stuff. You know, don't ask the Seattle police to be accountable to the Constitution of the United States. You know, you can't discipline them when they do bad stuff. House homeless people in non-existent affordable housing, but don't raise any taxes to do it. My God, don't raise any taxes. Increase public transportation to West Seattle, but again, don't raise taxes to do it. You know, the city can live within its own budget, et cetera, et cetera. A very sort of standard Republican platform that's not going over so well in progressive Seattle. Colding has so far raised just under $10,000, all of it small donations from individuals. And then the fourth candidate appears to be somebody who's not seriously running, Isaiah Willoughby. He has no website, no campaign literature, zero funding sources so far, no volunteers pushing his campaign or anything. So we know absolutely nothing about him. And like I said, so far, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce and Business Lobby has largely stayed out of the District 1 race. They're not supporting Lisa Herbold, but they have not thrown any money behind Tavel or Colding yet. We'll see if they do choose one or the other. My guess is if they do, they'll jump in behind Tavel, because he seems the one easiest for them to manipulate, since he has no policy platform yet. He is older than Colding, and so I think represents the sort of institutional, we're going to set things straight ticket better, I think, than Colding, who is younger and a bit more fiery.
So the election isn't till August. So
the primary isn't until August. Yeah.
So there's lots of time for the chamber to.
And I will keep an eye on that to let you know how that's going. There's lots of time for the chamber to jump in and pour money into that race. And
there's lots of time for.
But so far, there's not a great candidate there that they can get solidly behind, because, you know, not even any individual businesses have jumped in to support one candidate or the other. Usually, I think by this time, we'd see some real estate developers getting in. Into you know, supporting one candidate or the other, and we haven't seen that yet.
All right. Well, before we move on to national.
Yeah, that covers our local. I just want to put in a little plug for the station here. We're an all-volunteer station. This is an all-volunteer show, And if you like turning on your radio and being able to hear this all for free, just remember that it does cost us some money to pay the utility bills, pay the rent, and keep things running here. And we would appreciate your support. You can go to our website, kodxseattle.org. There's a Patreon button. You can become a regular sustaining supporter of the show, or you can send us a check to our address. And that address is?
Well, you want to make the check out to Earth on the Air Independent Media.
Mm-hmm.
And the address is P.O. Box 45883. Seattle, Washington, 98145. And
Repeat that again at the end of the show.
As important as that is, I also want to point out to people that we, in addition to broadcasting on Saturdays, we actually broadcast weekdays, too. And have a great lineup Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. We're looking at expanding those hours.
To evening hours.
Mm-hmm. To later this month or in June. And definitely check that out. Take a listen during the week. See what you think. We've got Democracy Now! At noontime every day. Tom Hartman, Flashpoints, other good shows as well. So as well as several other locally produced shows that we've got organizations that are signing on. For instance, the Post-Prison Education Program has a mm-hmm. regular show. And
that's a great group.
People's Harm Reduction Alliance, which is located here right in UTemple, where we're based. So many reasons to tune in during the week in addition to Saturdays. I was just looking at the online numbers, which I finally got to see yesterday.
Yeah.
And weekday could use your
support.
Your ears.
Yes.
So moving on to national and wow, what a continuing week on the abortion issues being
some serious challenges states. To Roe v. Wade this week. The Alabama state legislature passed the strictest anti-abortion bill in the nation, one that directly is meant to directly challenge Roe v. Wade. The law bans all abortions, with the only exception being when a mother's life is in danger, and it levies a penalty of up to 99 years in prison for any doctor who performs an abortion. At one point during the legislative process, while that bill was being considered, one Senate committee had added an exception for rape and incest to that bill. That caused an incredible outcry among the extreme Republicans who were pushing that bill and saying, you know, no exceptions, no exceptions. And the bill that passed eventually stripped that amendment back out. So it's not as if they passed this bill, you know, without considering, you know, rape or incest. No, they consider rape and incest okay, apparently. One sponsor of the bill, Republican Senator Clyde Chambliss, said, quote, "When God creates the miracle of life inside a woman's womb, it is not our place as human beings to extinguish that life," end quote. Now, I have to say, I think he's a little confused about how women's reproductive organs work. You know, usually there's a man and there's a woman. And I have to say that never in my experience does God get in between there. You know, usually there's a man and there's a woman. And when that man, for example, is a father and that woman is his teenage daughter, I would have to say that God is not even in the room when that's going on. So not allowing the exception for rape and incest is, I think, got to be one of the most horrible things I have ever seen in my life. But also the specter of seeing a group of aging white men pass this bill without even listening to the women in the room or listening to the women in their families about whether or not this is a good idea really kind of makes me sick to my stomach. Now, complete abortion bans have passed state legislatures before but been stopped cold. South Dakota's bill was repealed by voter referendum in 2006 when it was passed. Oklahoma also passed a ban in 2016, but its governor, thankfully, vetoed that bill, stopped it dead. This is the first time that a bill has been passed by the state legislature, signed into law by the governor, and there hasn't been a major outcry among the people in the state, but we'll see. That may yet happen. Now, Missouri's state legislature this week rushed to pass its own strict anti-abortion bill that criminalized criminalizes abortions past the eighth week of pregnancy. This was another fetal heartbeat bill that seeks to narrow as much as possible the time frame for when a woman can legally get an abortion. And I have to point out that many women don't even know that they're pregnant yet at 8 weeks. Sometimes it takes more than 12 weeks for them to realize that. In my mother's case, it took almost 16 weeks for her to realize she was pregnant with me. Now, other states have passed more restricted abortion laws this year, and those states include Georgia, Mississippi, Kentucky, and Ohio. Those were all fetal heartbeat bills too, narrowing the weeks in which a woman can learn that she's pregnant and get a legal abortion down to 6 to 8 weeks in all of those situations. Arkansas, Utah, and Iowa have also passed bills to narrow the time frame for women to get an abortion. Other states that are still working on similar bills include Louisiana, West Virginia, Florida, Texas, and South Carolina. You might ask, why in 2019 are so many of these bills getting passed now? Well, it's because Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed for the U.S. Supreme Court. He's widely seen as someone who will support overturning Roe v. Wade, which would mean now there's a significant majority of U.S. Supreme Court justices who would potentially support overturning Roe v. Wade. So anti-abortion groups think that 2019 is now the time, and that's why these bills are all passing now, and why we're seeing in Alabama for the first time a state legislature so easily pass a bill that almost completely restricts abortion access for all women under nearly all circumstances. There are also groups that are working hard to, and some states that are passing bills to institutionalize a woman's right to an abortion. One of the groups, NARAL, Pro-Choice, is holding a rally here in the state of Washington later this coming week, and we'll announce that in our events. And I highly suggest all women, regardless of your age, regardless of whether your status as a mother or not, and all men who support the women in their lives should turn out for that rally.
I believe those rallies are actually going to be nationwide.
Yeah. So,
many, many cities across.
Many,
the
many
US.
Cities. And I encourage everyone who's listening, wherever you are, to join those rallies. Now, you know, Congress could pass a bill that supersedes all state bills in terms of abortion. However, that if Congress were to, I mean, the Republicans in the current Congress probably would not pass the bill. But if, say, you know, in a couple of years, Democrats take over the Senate as well as the House, they could pass a bill that supersedes all state laws in terms of abortions. However, that bill would be challenged in court, and it would eventually make its way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court would have the final say. So this is, of course, the consequences that Democrats and that progressives have been pointing out all along about how the Republicans have been working so hard to stack the courts, particularly the upper courts, with conservative justices in order to do this kind of thing, eventually overturn Roe v. Wade. And my fear is that it's going to happen here fairly soon.
Yeah. Well, people have been pointing out, I mean, this has been part of the process and the engineering for a long time, you know, being cooked into the GOP plan. So
yeah, and I mean, even this year with Democrats in control of the House and Republicans in control of the Senate, Trump has been one of the most successful things of his presidency is his ability to pack the courts with conservative justices. I think the Senate has been doing hardly anything else in the last year other than approving as many Trump appointees as they can, but most particularly Trump appointees to the federal courts.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. San Francisco banning, or at least making a good try at facial recognition software.
Yeah. The San Francisco City Board of Supervisors passed a bill 8-1 to block the San Francisco police and other city agencies from using facial recognition technology, becoming the first city in the United States to do that. the federal government already uses facial recognition technology in most airports and ports of entry. A lot of stadiums, big major league stadiums, use it too. And so do many police departments around the country, including in New York City, Boston, Detroit, Las Vegas, San Diego, San Jose, and yes, the Seattle Police Department uses it as well. Now, 117 million people, or half of all Americans, have their photos available in National Police facial recognition databases, mostly through their driver's license photos. That's not true for your fingerprints or your DNA. Facial recognition technology is largely unregulated. And if you're an American adult with a driver's license, you have about a 50-50 chance of being in a perpetual police lineup without being aware of it and without having given your consent for it. Now, the difference between being in an actual police lineup and being in a facial recognition database is that an algorithm scans the lineup, not a human victim, in regards to facial recognition technology. And those algorithms are subject to a really high degree of error, especially when evaluating the photos of women and people of color, as multiple studies have shown. This has led some high-tech insiders, like Brad Smith, who's the president of Microsoft, to warn that Congress needs to step in and regulate facial recognition technology and software because companies can't be trusted to do that themselves. And when you consider that users of facial recognition technology, like police departments, border control, and other federal agencies, don't fully understand how the technology works and what its shortcomings are, they can be tempted to use it to violate people's privacy and their rights under the law, and they can often just get it wrong. And so wrong that not just are they temporarily violating people's privacy, but they could be jailing, expelling people, deporting people who are not the people that they think they are. That is a terrible injustice.
And these databases, you, again, just like the credit agencies, I mean, you don't have access as a citizen. You don't have access to any say about what's going into the databases. These places regularly mine places like Facebook for everybody's
photos.
And
30 states in the United States allow their database of driver's license photos to be accessed by police agencies with facial recognition software scanning capability. So, citizens need to go to their state governments and say, hey, close that door. Do not let that happen.
And that's just dealing with the state and, again, the government agencies. Again, mm-hmm. we've got private businesses that are using the same software for their own purposes.
For advertising, for finding out what your preferences are when you purchase online.
Or for security purposes.
How to target you with ads.
There's, for instance, an organization, Seattle Shield, here in Seattle, mm-hmm. that works with Seattle Police Department and individual businesses and corporations that share data regularly, things like facial recognition. And we have no, there's no transparency there. We have no insight into what
no
they're actually
doing. We have no idea on how they compile their database and how they present it and how the software or the other facial recognition technology actually works and whether or not it's accurate. Mm-hmm. Studies have shown that software produced by Amazon, by Microsoft, by Facebook, by other large tech companies can make terrible mistakes, particularly, like I said, when it comes to the photographs of women or photographs of people of color, people with darker skin, can really confuse the facial recognition software. Software that I should point out that was developed mostly by white men.
All right, moving on. Developments this week regarding Eric Garner's.
This week, after almost 5 years of waiting, the trial began of Officer Daniel Pantaleo. Pantaleo is accused of choking to death Eric Garner, an African-American man who was detained on Staten Island, New York, on a Staten Island, New York street corner because police thought he might be selling loose cigarettes. His death was caught on video, and the images really clearly show that Pantaleo was using a chokehold on Garner to take him to the ground. Garner says 11 times in that video, "I can't breathe." This phrase excuse me. This phrase went on to become a rallying cry for the Black Lives Matter movement and other people protesting police brutality. Now, on the first day of the trial in Pantaleo's case, internal affairs officers in the New York City Police Department testified that in the video, Pantaleo is clearly using a lethal chokehold that is forbidden by city police policy. And if you look at the video, as I did again last night, you can see that at one point, Pantaleo has him in a bar arm chokehold. Bar arm chokehold is where you have your forearm pressed very firmly against the person's windpipe. With using a bar arm chokehold, you can easily crush a person's windpipe, and that's a lethal maneuver. Bar arm chokeholds have been banned in most prisons and by most police departments for decades now. It's well known that you should never use a bar arm chokehold on another person unless you're trying to kill them. Now, the officer who oversaw the internal investigation of Pantaleo, he ordered the internal investigation unit to recommend disciplinary charges against Pantaleo, but his recommendations were ignored. A grand jury convened on Staten Island also opted not to bring charges against Officer Pantaleo. It took an outside independent group, the Civilian Complaint Review Board, to bring the charges that led to the trial this week. The FBI is still, after 5 years, investigating possible civil charges. And they have until July to potentially file those charges. But I think nobody really thinks that the Trump Department of Justice, which oversees the FBI, is going to follow through and do anything. So it's only this trial where Eric Garner's family can get some justice for his death. He did not deserve to die because some cops thought he might be selling a few loose cigarettes on the street. It was clearly an arrest motivated by his race because he was a large black man. Very clear. And if this video evidence showing the officer choking him to death doesn't produce a conviction, I don't know what would.
Well,
give me a second to get it together here.
I hate to say it, but I don't think that
I get pretty emotional about this stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, right. So we can move to international now.
Let's move on to something a little drier.
Yes.
Tariffs.
Oh, yeah. Trump lifting tariffs against Mexico and Canada. Trump offered on Friday to lift tariffs, and today it appears that the federal government is all set to do that, to lift tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Canada and Mexico under one condition. And this one condition didn't really make it into many of the news reports that I read about this. The one condition is that they don't buy cheaper steel and aluminum from China and then resell it in the United States. So essentially, it's a sneaky way, sort of a backdoor way, to get other countries to sign on to some of Trump's tariffs against China. In exchange, Trump is also promising to get his redo of NAFTA, what's called the U.S.-Canada-Mexico Agreement, passed in Congress. But Trump doesn't necessarily have the votes to do that, especially in the House. Now, the House and Senate, both the Democrats and Republicans, have said that they won't pass the agreement unless Trump lifts the steel and aluminum tariffs. He is doing that now. But, the Trump administration has made complete enemies of the Democratic majority in the House by refusing to release any documents related to Donald Trump's finances and the Mueller investigation. In addition, House Democrats have said that they won't pass his NAFTA redo unless Trump reopens the agreement to renegotiate labor protections and environmental protections, because it seriously lacks those in this new U.S.-Canada-Mexico agreement. now. In fact, there are a lot of people who are confused about Trump's trade deals. And I think it's really important to remember that Trump's goal isn't always to get an agreement and to lift tariffs. That's not necessarily his end goal. I think a lot of times his end goal is to just impose the tariffs and then keep them in place. I think Trump thinks that isolating the United States from world trade is going to revitalize U.S. manufacturing, and it's going to help the economy by bringing jobs home. He doesn't really look at the fact that world trade has created a lot of jobs here in the United States and that those jobs will be lost. One of the things that world trade, one of the areas that is highly reliant on world trade is the U.S. Agricultural industry. And it's that big lobbying group that has been putting a lot of pressure on Republicans in Congress, and they in turn have been putting pressure on Donald Trump to lift these steel and aluminum tariffs. Now, Trump still thinks, though, that we can mine, make, and grow everything we need here in the U.S. and consume it all, which is obviously not the case, without the help of the rest of the world. In fact, in his mind, the less contact with the rest of the world, the better. And that would pretty clearly explain his philosophy on immigration, too. I think it really plays to a very narrow, very paranoid, and very racist constituency of his and their view of the world.
And clarify for me, tariffs aren't picked up, the fee for the tariffs aren't picked up by, let's say, China.
No, they're essentially put on top of the good when it's imported. So it increases the price of the product to U.S. consumers. So it is U.S. consumers who pay the tariffs. It's a way for the government to sneakily collect more revenue from the American people after having extended a tax cut to people, to mostly rich people and big companies. Trump is recollecting that money in the form of these tariffs that are being paid by the U.S. consumer. That's everybody, including people who actually are paying more under the new U.S. tax law. That's a lot of people who are under median income.
All right, moving on. Finally, Iran developments there with
I think a lot of people are also confused about the news on Iran, too. Are we going to war with them? Are we not going to war with them? You know, what in the heck is happening? It can be a little scary when you start reading about it and you can't really figure out what the Trump administration is trying to do. You know, this in the last week or two,
I think the Trump administration isn't sure what the heck they're doing.
Is having some issues with that too. Yeah, you know, the U.S. has announced that we're sending an aircraft carrier group and a Patriot missile battery to the Persian Gulf. You know, why are we threatening war with Iran over what appear to be these vague warnings about possible attacks against American troops in the Middle East? And which troops are we talking about? You know, the ones in Iraq? The ones refueling Saudi jets flying their bombing campaigns over Yemen? The ones based in Saudi Arabia? Are you talking about U.S. troops in Syria? What about the ones that are based in Qatar? Or the ones in the United Arab Emirates? Or in Oman? Or the ones in Bahrain, in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan? In short, or the troops in Turkey? You know, in short, there are U.S. troops that are surrounding the nation of Iran. Which ones of those are you talking about Iran maybe having some problems with? You know, that's something that I think we need to ask, but something that the mainstream media doesn't ever really mention. And, you know, that's also not mentioning the U.S. sanctions, which the Trump administration are continuing to strengthen against Iran and which are now starting to really cripple the Iranian economy. And in the last couple of weeks, the Trump administration has sent Mike Pompeo to try to persuade our European allies and allies in Asia to join us in those sanctions, when those countries have said, no, we still don't see the rationale behind giving up the agreement that the Obama administration made with Iran. And they're still sticking to that agreement. They're not interested in slapping more sanctions on Iran. And so it appears now that the sanctions and that all of these hostile moves towards Iran appear to be designed to bring about regime change in Iran without actually having to send a lot of U.S. troops into the country to militarily overthrow the Iranian government. It's sanctions to force the people of Iran to suffer so much that they overthrow their own government. This is after Donald Trump had said that he was not interested in regime change. Well, we've seen the lie to that with Venezuela. The Trump administration sanctions have been designed to try to propel the Venezuelan economy into total collapse in order to lead to regime change in Venezuela. Also, the Trump administration has imposed sanctions on Cuba to try to impose regime change there. So Trump's foreign policy, he says one thing, he actually does another. But I think this week he was alarmed, even he was alarmed by how far John Bolton, his national security advisor, is willing to go to overthrow, to get militarily involved in regime change in Iran. Bolton is crazy, literally. He was quoted by The New Yorker as saying, quote, "Homo sapiens are hardwired for violent conflict. We're not going to eliminate violent conflict until Homo sapiens cease to exist as a separate species," end quote, which I think is not a great description of humanity at all, but a very, very good and concise description of John Bolton's own personality. And he has had a special hatred for Iran for decades, way back to before when he was picked up by the Bush administration to serve a very short term on a recess appointment as UN ambassador, and where he made enormous enemies of our European allies, who again are not likely to join us in any of these sanctions against Iran, because of course they know who the engineer is. It's John Bolton, and they will never agree to work with Bolton. So this week, Trump finally woke up and said that, no, we're not interested in war with Iran. Trying his best to put the brakes on John Bolton. But, you know, I think Bolton's a lot smarter than Donald Trump, and that is a scary situation.
All right. Events.
Yeah, there are a lot of events this week, starting with the University District Street Fair this weekend. So if you want to get out and enjoy the sun, come on down.
Taking place as we speak.
Yeah, come on down and check out the street fair. Tomorrow, on Sunday, Mimi Scheller discusses her book, Mobility Justice, which looks at inequality in transportation and the movement of people and resources in the United States and around the world. That's from noon to 1:45 p.m. at Northwest Film Forum at 1512 12th Avenue on Capitol Hill. That's hosted by 350 Seattle and Red May Seattle.
I heard her on a panel last night. She's great.
She's really good. Yeah. This is part of Red May's month of events that explore alternatives to capitalism. And you can find more events listed on the Red May website, redmayseattle.org. Also on Sunday, Extinction Rebellion is having another planning meeting from 2 to 4:30 p.m. at the West Seattle Public Library. That's at 2306 42nd Avenue Southwest.
Apparently, they're not interested in us being extinct.
No, they're trying to
they have
avoid.
Other plans.
Yeah, they're trying. That's why it's called Extinction Rebellion.
Oh, right.
On Monday is From Palestine to Mexico, All the Walls Have Got to Go, a discussion with Maru Mora Villapando and Nada Ilya to discuss organizing across borders and fighting police state tactics that are being used against immigrants and communities of color around the world. That's from 7 to 9 p.m. at Southside Commons at 3518 South Edmonds Street in Columbia City. On Tuesday, as I mentioned earlier, NARAL, Pro-Choice Washington, Northwest Abortion Access Fund, Planned Parenthood, and other groups are hosting a rally for abortion rights from noon to 1 p.m. at Seattle City Hall at 4th Avenue and James Street downtown. That's part of a national day of action to support abortion rights. You can also support those groups with your money. They do quite a bit of lobbying and other work to support abortion rights, and they always need support from the public. On Wednesday, the 22nd, there's a session called PSE, No More Gas Projects. It's a listening session with native groups, environmental groups, and Puget Sound Energy executives to talk about Puget Sound Energy's plans to expand natural gas production and processing in Washington State, particularly the construction of their liquefied natural gas plant in Tacoma, which we talked about last week on the show.
It continues to move forward despite Jay Inslee finally putting up
some resistance to it. Yeah, that's Wednesday from 4:30 to 8:30 p.m. And that's in Bellevue at 300 112th Avenue Southeast. Now, on Friday, there is a march in Diane to save life on planet Earth hosted by Extinction Rebellion. That march starts at Westlake Center on Friday at 1 p.m. at 4th and Pine downtown. So join in on that if you get a chance and you're not working on Friday. Also on Friday is the 5th annual Stand Up for Harm Reduction Variety Show to benefit the People's Harm Reduction Alliance, which provides drug treatment services and referrals, hepatitis C testing, and also runs the University District Needle Exchange. The show starts at 9 p.m. at the Highline Bar. That's at 210 Broadway Avenue East on Capitol Hill. If you support harm reduction and drug treatment referral services, then I suggest you showing up for that and showing some love to the People's Harm Reduction Alliance.
And it should be fun.
Yeah. And next weekend is the Folklife Festival at the Seattle Center. That starts on Friday, May 24th and runs through Monday, May 27th, Memorial Day. So check that out.
All right.
Again, if you support our show and the station, go to our website at kodxseattle.org and click on the Patreon button. Become a sustaining member of our group.